So the second case on today's oral argument calendar is case number A23-419, St. Paul Department of Human Rights and Equal Economic Opportunity versus CareMate Home Health Care, Inc. Counsel, I assume you're familiar with our oral argument protocols. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellants or relators counsel will then have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. Counsel for relator, you may approach the lectern. Please introduce.
We have a camera in the regular courtroom.
I'm sorry.
Just like taking pictures of the court.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Please don't do that. Thank you. Counsel for relator, thank you. Counsel for appellant or relator, you may please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jake Fox. I'm an attorney with Dudley & Smith, PA, counsel for the appellant in this matter, CareMate Home Health Care, Incorporated. This case is about the City of St. Paul Department of Human Rights and Equal Economic Opportunities' failure to provide CareMate with a meaningful opportunity to participate in the department's investigation into alleged violations of St. Paul City Ordinance Chapter 233, as well as the Human Rights and Equal Economic Opportunities Commission's failure to consider CareMate's evidence on administrative appeal. The basic facts of the case, as far as what transpired during the department's investigation, as well as CareMate's subsequent appeal to the commission, are generally accepted by both parties. However, the interpretation and application of the department's findings of fact as part of their investigation, as applied to the legal standard outlined in Chapter 233 of the ordinance, are what are in dispute and what this court would review de novo. The facts of this case are straightforward. The City of St. Paul has what's known as an Earned Sick and Safe Time Ordinance, in which employees who qualify for work within the city limits earn 1 hour of what's considered Earned Sick and Safe Time benefit for every 30 hours worked within the city. They can accrue up to 45 hours of this benefit.
Mr. Fox, I'm going to interrupt you because we're all quite familiar with the facts of the case.
Sure.
If I could jump ahead to your second argument about that you allege the department exceeded its authority. I'm looking at page 19 of your brief, where you say the department failed to enforce the ordinance according to their established procedures. Could you please be specific about which procedures were not followed?
Absolutely. When the department initiates an investigation based on a complaint received pursuant to the ordinance, what happens is that the department sends out an initial notice of investigation. This notice of investigation is twofold. First, it notifies the employer that a complaint has been received, and the second part of that is that it outlines the pertinent facts and the allegations made against the employer. This is important in regards because part of the investigation process after the notice of investigation is received requires the employer to submit a written position statement. Basically,
So if I may interrupt. So I guess the purpose of my question was to ask you to identify the specific procedure in law, like for example in the ordinance itself. Is there a particular provision of the ordinance or of the rules concerning the ordinance? Is there some procedure that's in either of those documents that the department failed to follow?
Sure. Want to make sure I get the citation to this right. So the ordinance under Chapter 233, I believe it is .07 when it comes to sending out that notice and the contents of the notice of the investigation. The notice period initiates the investigation. The department or the employer then has 30 days to respond to the notice of investigation, which typically consists of providing additional documentation as requested in the notice. The city's respondent brief noted on a couple things that I'd like to address here today. In particular, the city noted that any deficiencies in its notice of investigation were cured by the subsequent back and forth between the city's investigator and CareMate. The problem with this is that this prevented CareMate from adequately drafting and responding to these to the allegations made in the notice.
Council, I just to follow up on Judge Johnson's question, I had a similar question after reading all of the materials, and that is, where in the ordinances does it spell out exactly what the city must provide in terms of notice that you didn't get?
Sure, absolutely. So in the ordinance, it says, and again, I believe it is 233.07 in the city ordinance that says.
I wonder if you're if I may interrupt?
Yeah, go ahead.
I wonder if you intend to refer to point 13.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely.
Respondent addendum 28 in the.
Let me.
Point 07 has to do with the notice.
The notice,
that,
correct.
That employers must give, but as far as procedures.
Sure.
Point 13 is the investigation. Labeled enforcement.
Yes. So in 13, subsection 13 spells out is the initial notice, without a doubt, that the employer has 30 days to respond to the notice of investigation. But the specific part in 213 that I want, or section, subsection 13 that I want to spell out is that the notice of investigation must include the pertinent facts and specify the allegations made on the made against the employer.
And where is that in the ordinance?
That is under 233.13.
What part of 233.13?
Let me take a look here and verify that here. Oh, shoot. I'm sorry, can I grab one thing from my desk? Thank you. Okay, so apologies for my
don't apologize. It's fine.
Back forth here. So to answer your question, we're looking at chapter 233.13, the enforcement section, specifically subsection B1, which begins with the investigative process beginning with the notice of investigation, and this part is key here following up. Setting forth the allegations and pertinent facts.
So then what about the notice, what allegations and pertinent facts were missing from the notice?
Absolutely. So in the notice specifically said that the department had received a complaint alleging that CareMate had failed to front load and credit earned sick and safe time pursuant to 233.03 and 233.04. The problem with this is that there were no pertinent facts included. It just said that a complaint was received alleging these violations, but it didn't provide any additional information as far as what CareMate had done or hadn't done to violate that.
So when I look at the ordinance and the subsection that you're referencing, Council,
yes.
It falls under the part of the enforcement section that discusses the investigation process.
Correct.
And the way that we generally think about a notice is we're notifying you that we received a complaint that alleged the following things, and now we're going to investigate you.
Sure.
And so I'm not reading this part of, I'm speaking for myself and not my colleagues, but I'm not reading this part of the ordinance as a requirement that the enforcing entity is required to spell out every single potential fact that it might uncover during an investigatory process. Oftentimes complaints, you know, are very brief and don't contain a lot of detail.
Sure.
So that's really my question. What else, given what the city knew at the time that it initiated this investigation, was it required to disclose so that your client could have a fulsome participation in the investigation process?
Absolutely. And by no means are we expecting that the notice of investigation would be comprehensive as far as all the findings. Obviously, you're absolutely right in saying it's initiating an investigation. The investigation is subsequent to follow. The important thing here that I'll note is that the notice of investigation triggers a 30-day period for the employer, in this case, to draft and send out its written position statement. And what is important about that is that the written position statement is essentially the second salvo. The notice of investigation initiates the investigation from the department's perspective. The notice of investigation from the department. The written position statement is the second response to the department from the employer. And in that written position statement, it gives the employer an opportunity to, again, touch on any allegations that are made, in this instance, accruing and front-loading earned sick and safe time, but then also address pertinent facts, whether it's admitting, denying, or quantifying, to sort of help frame the investigation going forward. So
let's assume that the notice is somehow deficient in by the city. Was your client prevented from presenting certain evidence that it wanted to present in its own defense, or would you have presented something different had you had better notice? I'm wondering how your client is harmed by maybe not having a perfect notice.
Sure. What I would say is that as far as the question of perfect versus imperfect notice, there's always the potential for ambiguities. In fact, hindsight's 20/20 in this regard. But what I would say is that if you go through the beginning, middle, to end of the investigation and the administrative appeal process, you'll see that there's many instances where the department and CareMate were not on the same page as far as what was being investigated, what was needed from CareMate. CareMate, in several instances, provided evidence of its notice policy, the pictures of its earned sick and safe time posters in its primary place of employment, also providing the notice as part of its employee handbook. But a lot of the findings that were included in the department's determination of violation, included words like unable to verify or failed to consider. And in this regard, it speaks more to the investigation itself versus the absence or presence of an earned sick and safe time policy and notice requirement. Because something couldn't be verified, in reviewing the determination, says that both sides, for one reason or another, were not on the same page as far as what was being investigated, what was being provided, and based off those two, what the findings would be.
To follow up on Judge Frisch's question, did you or your client ever offer or ask permission to provide more evidence, which was denied?
No, Your Honor. The department was there was a back and forth as far as requests for evidence and then providing that evidence. The concern here in particular when it comes to the department's investigation was that based off the department, CareMate's written position statement, the department, as part of its investigation, conducted 8 interviews with eight of CareMate's employees. Common practice, not anything that CareMate has any issue with. The concern in those interviews is that CareMate was not provided an opportunity to respond to those findings until after the determination of violation had come out, at which point those interviews were outlined, the issues were laid out, and a lot of the questions and concerns that were raised from the findings of those interviews could easily have been addressed had they been made available to CareMate while the investigation was ongoing, not at the point of the determination of violation.
Was the company unaware during the investigation that people were being interviewed?
Yes, they were. Their understanding at that point was that there was a complainant that came forward, the identity of which was not provided, and in that regard, that's understandable. When the department receives a complaint from an employee, certain safeguards being in place to protect their identity and any potential fallback on that. But CareMate was unaware of any interviews of its employees until after the determination of violation.
Your initial allotment of time has expired. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Gorski, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent in this matter. The City of St. Paul is a home rule charter city vested with the authority to ensure the health and welfare of all the residents of the City of St. Paul, save for any authority that's explicitly or impliedly withheld by the state of Minnesota. Pursuant to this authority, it passed its Earned Sick and Safe Time Ordinance in 2016, which provides a minimal amount of guaranteed paid leave by employers to their employees within the City of St. Paul. This leave is for individuals to provide for their own health needs or those of their families. It provides protections to victims of domestic abuse. And in general, it ensures the health and welfare and economic security of the residents of the City of St. Paul by preventing a difficult choice at times of caring for their own health versus maintaining their job. In this case, the city received a complaint from an employee of the relator. They spoke with several employees and they sent a notice to the relator of the violation, of the notice of potential violation. The relator responded in accordance with the documents that were requested by the city, and immediately looking at the payroll records, a stark pattern jumped right off the page. There was a whole class of employees employed by the relator that were not using any sick leave for an extended period of time, approximately 19 months or nearly 2 years, that no personal care attendants were using any of the sick leave that they were entitled to. Contrast this with the fact that Relator also employs a substantial number of administrative employees that work in the office in St. Paul. Those people were using paid time. And so there was clearly a whole class of employees who are field workers, not working in the office. They work in the homes of the people that they provide service to, who didn't use any paid leave. Couple this fact that jumped off the page with the statements that the department was hearing from those 8 employees, plus the complainant, and it seemed to substantiate that what the employees were saying. And some of the things the employees were saying that were that they could take time off, but it was unpaid, or they had to trade shifts. There was no notice that they had received, and they had never seen any notice poster. They were unaware that ESST applied to them. They would have used it had it been available. One employee even said she took her maternity leave entirely unpaid when ESST would have covered at least a portion of that leave. And a longtime employee said that she had just stopped asking if there was any paid time off because she knew, in her words, that there was none. Regarding the employee statements.
Mr. Gorski, if I could ask about that, is there any provision in either the ordinance or the rules or any other provision of law that provides the respondent company with entitlement to be present for interviews such as the ones that were conducted?
There is not. In this case, the due process and the right to respond was satisfied through the process that was afforded to the relator. Certainly, if the department were solely acting on the testimony of the employees that they had spoken with, there would be a stronger claim to question those witnesses or do some sort of cross-examination. But in this case, the department was looking at what the employees were saying and then following up on those allegations and asking for evidence, which would have, if provided, countered those claims. I will note the department, although this certainly doesn't, this doesn't supersede the relator's due process rights, the department is under an obligation in the administrative code to ensure the confidentiality of complainants and witnesses to the extent that they can do so. Because oftentimes in cases like this, when employees and witnesses come forward, there's a power dynamic, there's a power imbalance. They open themselves up to potential retaliation, and that can have a chilling effect on people coming forward. So the department, the reason the department proceeded to ask for further evidence was both to give the relator opportunity to respond and also to protect the identities of these employees.
And to what extent did the investigation determine that field workers, as you call them, were in fact taking leave, were on leave status, but not paid?
Those conclusions are based on some statements that the employees provided to the department, but also
my question is to what extent? How many instances were there where there was actually leave taken, but unpaid, as opposed to no leave whatsoever?
The department did not tally a total of how many times that leave was taken. The relator did reference to the investigator and also argued before the Hero Commission that part of the reason why there was no ESST taken was that it was a common practice for employees to use what they call flex time or to simply take the leave unpaid.
And did the interviews explore that subject?
The interviews did explore that subject. There were several of the employees that the investigator spoke to said they had taken time off, but they had always taken it unpaid.
Okay. Thank you.
Regarding the sufficiency of the notice, there are basically three. The ordinance is something of a long ordinance, but there are basically three issues that were covered in the notice, two of which are closely related. First is the notice to the employees, and then the second and third are the usage and accrual. Regarding the notice to the employees, the investigation, as we mentioned before, uncovered that PCAs don't work in the office; they work in the field.
So I'm looking at the July 16 letter. I don't see the word notice. I'm sorry, am I missing it? Is it in the? I see the issue about front loading or accruing ESST, the issue about employees may not be receiving full pay. Go ahead and answer my question if you understand it.
Your Honor, I don't recall off the top of my head where in the notice that was provided. It was certainly discussed throughout the investigation as the investigation proceeded. Of course, the department was not aware of all the facts when the investigation starts. So as the investigation proceeded, essentially. What ended up happening, and the reason that notice was included in the determination, was that there were conversations between the department and the relator about, well, if these people don't come into the office, how are they notified? And the relator stated, we get acknowledgments from our employees, which will show that they were notified of this. And so the department asked the logical follow-up question, can you provide these? They said yes. And then when they provided the notifications, they were unsigned. The department again followed up and said, these are unsigned. Do you have signed acknowledgments? And the relator's response was, we didn't start this process of having these acknowledgments be signed until 2020, which was right around the time the investigation started and right around the time when the first hours of ESST were taken by any PCAs. To sum up the investigation, it followed the evidence. The department received the complaint from the employees, interviewed employees, asked for information from the relator following up on those allegations. The department followed up on relator statements and also clarified with the relator on several occasions not just what it was seeking, but why it was seeking those documents. And ultimately what ended up happening is that the relator simply failed to substantiate the claims that they made to the department. And This process is appropriate to protecting the interests of the relator, their property interests, protects safeguards against any erroneous deprivation, and finally, requiring a more robust process of, you know, interviewing more employees, allowing for cross-examination when there are other avenues available to reach the conclusion would have been overly burdensome to the department. On the question of authority, I'll note two provisions in the ordinance that give the department broad authority to investigate in the manner in which this investigation proceeded. And that's that this was an investigation into a matter that wasn't an instance of an individual employee asking for paid leave and then being denied. It was a systemic violation by the relator where no employees were notified, no employees enjoyed any accrual rights or usage rights from the relator. The provisions of the ordinance that give the department this authority are 233.13A and 233.13D. 233.13A allows the department to investigate any suspected violation. And this, to say any suspected violation, we have to include structural violations. We can't, there's no reason to handcuff the department and say they can't look at a pattern and establish that there's a broader issue here than just the one employee before them. And regarding the damages that are ordered, 233.1D authorizes the department to order any appropriate relief based on the violation that's occurred. In this case, the department made a reasonable calculation, not of any fines or fees, simply made a reasonable calculation of what the expected usage would have been over that time period. And I think that's very important to understand, is that the department did not order back wages of all sick time that would have accrued in that time, simply what would have been expected to have been used by those employees.
Based upon, how was that expected usage? What was it based on?
That expected usage was based on a calculation by the CDC about the average number of sick days taken per year by employees in the United States.
Which is about three, as I recall?
About 3.5 days for a full-time worker, and of course it's prorated then for how, so if you work half-time, you would be expected to take about half the amount of sick leave.
And the department used the number 3.5 or a prorated number for 1 year or a longer period?
It used the number for the investigation period that was noted in the investigation. So it was about a 19-month period. And finally, regarding the allegation that the decision here was arbitrary or capricious, this decision wasn't arbitrary or capricious. It simply was a conclusion based on the evidence and the investigation that had been conducted. The relator in this case is asking this court to substitute its own interpretation of the facts for the interpretation that was borne out through the investigation, both by the investigator, the director of the HERO Department, and the HERO Commission. The evidence showed that there was no usage of ESST for a whole class of employees over a two-year period of over 100 very similarly situated employees. The relator argued throughout the investigation and on appeal that these individuals would rather have simply taken unpaid time than use their paid leave. The investigator disagreed. They didn't find that to be a credible argument. The city doesn't believe it's a credible argument, and for these reasons, we ask that the court uphold the HERO Commission's determination, upholding the department's determination. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gorski. Mr. Fox, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. To touch on a couple of things, picking up from my previous argument, specifically relating to the investigation of the earned sick and safe time usage by CareMate. CareMate is not expecting a perfect open and shut investigation. What CareMate's concern is with this investigation is that they were not provided a fair, comprehensive investigation. And what I mean by that is that there was fact-finding and exchange of information by the department and CareMate, but the information wasn't going both ways. And what I mean by that is the department was requesting information from CareMate specific to findings they had made from these interviews with aid of CareMate's employees, but they weren't, the department wasn't providing sort of insight or reasoning behind what was being requested to sort of direct the investigation as far as CareMate's understanding and expectation of what was being requested.
I mean, what you just said seems inconsistent with some of the emails that I've reviewed that show emails between the investigator and the company contact where the investigator is explaining what she's looking for and the reasons why she's looking for it and so on. Doesn't that satisfy that concern?
To an extent, the concern there, and I'm familiar with the emails that you're referring to, is that the emails are specific to suggesting why a specific statement or document is being, or explanation is being requested, but it doesn't say, and it's specific to notice or providing the benefit information upon request or accruing or carrying over the benefit and from year to year. It was more so specific to what was being requested. We need this to verify this. It wasn't, this document is needed to verify this information, which touches on notice, perhaps. So, and the, again, the CareMate is not expecting a absolute comprehensive investigation to the extent that every one of its 114 employees are being interviewed and that the department is nickel and diming the earned sick and safe time used and the earned sick and safe time that hasn't been used and sort of calculating any potential remedy based off that. But the problem here is that the department failed to consider CareMate's unique area of employment while incorporating a national average sick days taken provided by the CDC, suggests a willingness to incorporate external consideration, but an inconsistent. And what I mean by that is the department was willing to look towards the CDC guidelines, nothing of which is outlined or required in the ordinance, but when it came to CareMate providing a fair and descriptive explanation of its unique area of law, specifically employing part-time PCAs, the majority of whom work in their home, providing care for immediate family members, and the ability of these PCAs to flex their time, meaning if it doesn't work because of any reason, even unrelated to earned sick and safe time, for any shift, they can flex that within the set schedule. And this is beneficial in the sense that if they're providing care to a family member, then it's immediately touches on the PCA as well as the family member. If it doesn't work for the care, the PCA, then the family member is in the loop and there's not this jostling for care that the PCA and the patient are in constant communication with one another.
Is there any data in the record that the city could have used instead of that 3.5 number? Any data that's more case specific or that does actually show the history of this category of employees at your work for your company?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. This is really, it was more so the narrative behind providing requested explanation and documents to the department was saying, here are our payroll statements, here are the documents are upon being requested showing earned sick and safe time, accrual, distribution, carryover, things like that. And then the explanation being, these are what the statements and the numbers are, and this is the explanation that we have for it.
How many of the employees were family members, PCAs?
That
is fairly common, I understand, I know. But
It is common. I don't have an exact number. I mean, I could speculate, but it is fairly consistent. And a lot of these PCAs, it isn't just providing care for family members, but they there is a number of them that provide PCA services elsewhere with other agencies. All right. Sorry if there are any more questions. Otherwise, appellant would ask that the court reverse the department's determination based on the arguments and brief submitted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.